I rose early next morning, and drawing back the damask curtain that sheltered my window, looked out at the scene below. I saw a stable yard, a spacious quadrangle surrounded by the closed doors of stables and dog kennels, low massive buildings of gray stone with an ancient moss-grown look that gave them a weird kind of interest in my eyes. This range of stabling must have been disused for a long time, I fancied. I had often heard how the present squire's grandfather had kept a pack of hounds which had been sold immediately after his death, and I knew the reigning lord of the abbey, Mr. George Crichton, was not a hunting man. He had indeed a secret horror of the sport, for more than one scion of the house had perished untimely in the hunting field. On too many occasions, a violent death had come between the heir and his inheritance. I used to wonder whether my cousin Fanny was ever troubled by morbid forebodings about her only and fondly loved son. Was there a ghost at Crichton, that spectral visitant without which the state and splendor of a grand old house seemed scarcely complete? Yes, I had heard vague hints of some shadowy presence that had been seen on rare occasions within the precincts of the abbey, but I had never been able to ascertain what shape it bore. Those whom I questioned were prompt to assure me that they had seen nothing. Once, when I had spoken of the subject to my cousin George, he told me angrily never again to let him hear any allusion to that folly from my lips. That December passed merrily. The old house was full of really pleasant people, and the brief winter days were spent in one unbroken round of amusement and gaiety. To me, the old, familiar English country house life was a perpetual delight. I could not have believed myself capable of being so completely happy. I saw a great deal of my cousin Edward, and I think he contrived to make Miss Tremaine understand that to please him she must be gracious to me. She certainly took some pains to make herself agreeable to me, and I discovered that in spite of that proud, disdainful temper, she was really anxious to gratify her lover. Their courtship was not altogether a halcyon period. They had frequent quarrels, the details of which Edward's sisters, Sophie and Agnes, delighted to discuss with me. It was the struggle of two proud spirits for mastery, but my cousin Edward's pride was of the nobler kind, the lofty scorn of all things mean, a pride that does not ill become a generous nature. To me he seemed all that was admirable, and I was never tired of hearing his mother praise him. She used to confide in me as fully as if I had been her sister. "I dare say you can see I am not quite so fond as I should wish to be of Julia Tremaine," she said to me one day. "But I am very glad that my son is going to marry. My husband's has not been a fortunate family, you know, Sarah. The eldest sons have been wild and unlucky for generations past, and when Edward was a boy, I used to have many a bitter hour dreading what the future might bring forth. Thank God he has been and is all that I can wish. Yet I am not the less glad of his marriage. The heirs of Crichton, who have come to an untimely end, have all died unmarried. There was Hugh Crichton, who was killed in a duel. John, who broke his back in the hunting field 30 years later. Theodore, shot accidentally by a schoolfellow at Eton. Jasper, whose yacht went down in the Mediterranean 40 years ago. An awful list, is it not, Sarah? I shall feel as if my son were safer somehow when he is married. It will seem as if he has escaped the ban that has fallen on so many of our house. He will have greater reason to be careful of his life when he is a married man." I agreed with Mrs. Crichton, but could not help wishing that Edward had chosen any other woman than the cold, handsome Julia. Christmas came by and by, a real old English Christmas. Frost and snow without, warmth and revelry within, skating on the great pond in the park and sledging on the ice-bound high roads by day, private theatricals, charades, and amateur concerts by night. I was surprised to find that Miss Tremaine refused to take any active part in these evening amusements. She had the air and bearing of a princess for whose diversion all our entertainments had been planned. No desire to show off appeared to enter her mind. Her intense pride left no room for vanity. Yet I had heard her sing and play, and I knew that both as a vocalist and a pianist, she excelled all our guests.
"Don't ye remember the other night, when ye were in the tavern, and ye drank?"
Sophie and Agnes and I had many a happy morning and afternoon, going from cottage to cottage in a pony carriage laden with Mrs. Crichton's gifts to the poor of her parish. Agnes and Sophie, aided by an indefatigable maid, the rector's daughter, and one or two other young ladies, had been at work for the last 3 months, so that on Christmas morning every child in the parish was arrayed in a complete set of new garments. Mrs. Crichton had an admirable faculty of knowing precisely what was most wanted in every household. Edward used sometimes to drive us on these expeditions, and I found that he was eminently popular among the poor of Crichton Parish. He had an airy, pleasant manner which set them at their ease at once. He never forgot their names or relationships or wants or ailments, and was full of jokes which may not have been particularly witty, but which used to make the small, loved-roofed chambers ring with hearty laughter. Miss Tremaine coolly declined any share in these pleasant duties. "I don't like poor people," she said. "I dare say it sounds very dreadful, but it's just as well to confess my iniquity at once. I never can get on with them, or they with me. The close, faint odor of their houses gives me a fever, and again, what is the use of visiting them? It is only an inducement to them to become hypocrites. Surely it is better to arrange on a sheet of paper what is just and fair for them to have, and let them receive the things from some trustworthy servant. In that case, there need be no cringing on one side and no endurance on the other." "But you see, Julia, there are some people to whom that sort of thing is not a question of endurance," Edward answered, his face flushing indignantly. "People who like to share in the pleasure they give, who like to see the poor, careworn faces lighted up with sudden joy, who like to make them feel some friendly link between the cottage and the great house. There is my mother, for instance. All these duties which you think so tiresome are to her an unfailing delight. There will be a change, I'm afraid, Julia, when you are mistress of the Abbey." "You have not made me that yet," she answered, "and there is plenty of time for you to change your mind if you do not think me suited for the position. I do not pretend to be like your mother. It is better that I should not affect any feminine virtues which I do not possess." After this, Edward insisted on driving our pony carriage almost every day, leaving Miss Tremaine to find her own amusement, and I think this conversation was the beginning of an estrangement between them, which became more serious than any of their previous quarrels had been. I was surprised when she beckoned me aside one morning and slipped a little purse of gold, 20 sovereigns, into my hand. "I shall be very much obliged if you will distribute that among your cottagers today, Miss Crichton," she said. "Of course I should like to give them something. It's only the trouble of talking to them that I shrink from, and you are just the person for an almoner. Don't mention my little commission to anyone, please." "Of course I may tell Edward," I said. "To him least of all," she answered eagerly. "You know that our ideas vary on that point. He would think I gave the money to please him. Not a word, pray, Miss Crichton." I submitted and distributed my sovereigns quietly, with the most careful exercise of my judgment. So Christmas came and passed, and it was the day after the great anniversary, a grand occasion for the servants who were to have their annual ball to which all the humbler class of tenantry were invited. The frost had broken up suddenly, and it was a thorough wet day, a depressing kind of day for anyone whose spirits are liable to be affected by the weather, as mine are. I felt out of spirits for the first time since my arrival at the Abbey. I sat in one of the deep windows, half hidden by the curtains, reading a novel. If the picture within was bright and cheerful, the prospect was dreary enough without. The fairy forest of snow-wreathed trees, the white valleys and undulating banks of snow had vanished, and the rain dripped slowly and sullenly upon a darksome expanse of sodden grass and a dismal background of leafless timber. All was silence and gloom. Edward Crichton was pacing the drawing-room to and fro from end to end with an air that was at once moody and restless. "Thank heaven the frost has broken up at last!" he exclaimed, quite unaware of my close neighborhood. "What bad taste to prefer such weather as this to frost and snow!" I answered. "The park looked enchanting yesterday, a real scene from fairyland, and only look at it today." "Oh, yes, of course, from an artistic point of view, the snow was better," The place does look something like the Great Dismal Swamp today, but I am thinking of hunting, and that confounded frost made a day's sport impossible. We are in for a spell of mild weather now, I think. But you are not going to hunt, are you, Edward? Indeed I am, my gentle cousin, in spite of that frightened look in your amiable countenance. I thought there were no hounds hereabouts. Nor are there, but there is as fine a pack as any in the country. The Daleborough hounds, 25 miles away. And you are going 25 miles for the sake of a day's run? I would travel 40, 50, 100 miles for that same diversion, but I am not going for a single day this time. I am going over to Sir Francis Wickerley's place for 3 or 4 days. I am due today, but I scarcely care to travel in such rain as this. However, if the floodgates of the sky are loosened for a new deluge, I must go tomorrow. What a headstrong young man, I exclaimed. And what will Miss Tremaine say to this desertion? I asked in a lower voice. Miss Tremaine can say whatever she pleases. She had it in her power to make me forget the pleasures of the chase if she had chosen. Oh, I begin to understand. This hunting engagement is not of long standing? No. I began to find myself bored here a few days ago and wrote to offer myself for 2 or 3 days at Wickerley. I received a most cordial answer by return and am booked till the end of the week. You have not forgotten the ball on the first? Oh, no. To do that would be to vex my mother and to offer a slight to our guests. I shall be here for the first, come what may. Come what may? So lightly spoken. The time came when I had bitter occasion to remember those words. I'm afraid you will vex your mother by going at all, I said. You know what a horror both she and your father have of hunting. A most uncountry gentleman-like aversion on my father's part. But he is a dear old bookworm, seldom happy out of his library. Yes, I admit they both have a dislike to hunting in the abstract, but they know I am a pretty good rider and that it would need a bigger country than I shall find about Wickerley to floor me. You need not feel nervous, my dear Sarah. I'm not going to give Papa and Mama the smallest ground for uneasiness. You will take your own horses, I suppose? Well, that goes without saying. No man who has cattle of his own cares to mount another man's horses. I shall take Pepperbox and the Druid. Pepperbox has a queer temper, I have heard your sisters say. My sisters expect a horse to be a kind of overgrown baa lamb. Everything splendid in horse flesh and womankind is prone to that slight defect, an ugly temper. There is Miss Tremaine, for instance. I shall take Miss Tremaine's part. I believe it is you who are in the wrong in the matter of this estrangement, Edward. Do you? Well, right or wrong, my cousin, and until the fair Julia comes to me with sweet looks and gentle words, we can never be what we have been. You will return from your hunting expedition in a softer mood, I answered. That is to say, if you persist in going, but I hope and believe you will change your mind. Such a change is not within the limits of possibility, Sarah. I am fixed as fate. He strolled away, humming some gay hunting song as he went. I was alone with Mrs. Crichton later in the afternoon, and she spoke to me about this intended visit to Wickerley. Edward has his heart set upon it, evidently, she said regretfully, and his father and I have never interfered with Edward's enjoyment of the sport. I have had many a bitter hour, I can assure you, my dear, when my son has been away in Leicestershire, hunting 4 days a week. He rides well, I suppose. Superbly. I dare say, when he is master of the Abbey, he will start a pack of hounds and revive the old days of his great-grandfather, Meredith Crichton. I fancy the hounds were kenneled in the stable-yard below my bedroom window in those days. Were they not, Fanny? Yes, Mrs. Crichton answered gravely, and I wondered at the sudden shadow that fell upon her face.